Welcome to Sober Dad Crew, the podcast where we talk about all things dad, sobriety, recovery, parenting, music, tattoos, and more. For more information or to get in touch, visit SoberDadCrew.com. My guest this episode is Matt Charlilio, managing partner of The Empty Bottle in Chicago. The Empty Bottle is a music venue and bar that places special emphasis on supporting its clients in recovery and sobriety by providing safe spaces and non-alcoholic options. Matt, welcome to Sober Dad Crew.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you live in the city I lived in for a while. I was there in the mid to late 90s, which is, I believe, around the time your music venue, The Empty Bottle, was really just starting up.
Yeah. I'm actually in the Airbnb above Empty Bottle right now, so you might hear a little bit of sound check bleed through. Hopefully not, but yeah, we actually have Local H playing tonight.
I like a good sound check. I used to work at the State Theater in Ithaca, and sound check was kind of always a cool time because no one was there, and you could kind of just sit. That was an 1,800 seat historic theater, and you can kind of just sit there and watch and listen, and there's sort of the calm before the storm with grumpy patrons. And I'm sure you've got stories of that stuff. I certainly have some stories of who you thought was going to be cool, who was not, and maybe vice versa.
100%.
When did you start working at The Empty Bottle?
So I started working here when I turned 21. So that would be about 14 years ago at this point. Yeah, I had been playing with my old band at the Bottle a few times beforehand and immediately was like, oh, this place is awesome. I should try to get a job here. So yeah, that worked out nicely.
Was that in your cover letter?
I think, yeah, my cover letter was as simple as like me coming in for sound check and having a beer and then being like, hey, do you want to work door here? Yeah.
A lot of people have worked door at places who then, you know, have taken off in their career or had other involvement. Are you a Chicago native?
No, I moved here. I'm originally from the East Coast, born in Connecticut and lived in Maine for a little while. And then as a teenager, kind of bopped around the country, finishing up school. So I finished high school in Colorado and I had some family living out here. And they were like, oh, the music scene's great in Chicago. You should come and move out here. And, you know, being an 18-year-old trying to, you know, pave a musical career, jumped on it. And so yeah, I guess I've been living here almost 17, 18 years or something like that.
All right. Where in Maine? I grew up in Maine.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, we got back yesterday from visiting my folks.
Oh, that's awesome.
In Falmouth, so right outside of Portland.
Yeah, totally.
Also a great city.
Yeah, I love Portland. I was visiting out there maybe 5 years ago, just before the pandemic. But yeah, I was in Wiscasset.
I know Wiscasset. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Expensive lobster rolls.
Yep. Yeah. Not a lot going on.
Not a lot going on at all. And then, from there, I moved to Durham, which is just outside of Freeport.
Yep. Yeah, so I grew up in Falmouth. Then my parents lived in New Gloucester for a bunch of years after my brother and I had left. And now they're back in a retirement place in Falmouth. So we're there at least a couple of times a year.
Oh, that's awesome.
Haul the whole crew. Grab an Airbnb now because now that I remarried, there's too many of us to cram in their retirement place. So a little bittersweet. My mom has dementia, so every visit's just a little, you don't quite know what you're going to get. But I ended up in Chicago because my older brother went to the University of Chicago. And I went to college in Portland, Oregon, good city as well. But it was so friggin' expensive there when I moved there. And I graduated and I worked in a bookstore, which was great. I mean, working in a bookstore is pretty great, except it doesn't pay you anything. And it was the time lots of folks from California were moving up there. So it was hard to get entry-level jobs. So I landed on his couch in the Woodlawn neighborhood and started working with gang kids there and helped run this bike shop, Blackstone Bikes, mm-hmm. on South Blackstone Avenue. And we collected bikes and kids fixed up the bikes and they could earn a bike and job skills.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, and there's a bunch of artists who are in this same space. This guy, Dan Peterman, who teaches at the Art Institute. So it's like a really interesting kind of vibrant thing on this dead end block on the south side where, you know, University of Chicago told all their students not to go, which is now probably a highly gentrified neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, and I'm sure the neighborhood around the empty bottle has really shifted in the years since I've been there. Like that was not like Wicker Park. I recall was just sort of coming up and becoming the cool place. Like the artists had been there for a little while and different parts of the north side. I'm sure now it's just totally outrageously expensive. And
yeah, it's definitely interesting. I mean, even just in my time in Chicago, like you were saying, Wicker Park was probably just up and coming in your time here. But when I moved here in 2007, like Wicker Park was like the mecca of like DIY spaces for bands, and like all the artists and college kids lived in Wicker Park. So it was like the big happening area. You can definitely see that spill over into Ukrainian Village now. Yeah, like where Empty Bottle is in Ukrainian Village, like there's, I mean, in the last 14 years or so, like an immense amount of families and like sort of upper middle class have moved into the area, which isn't necessarily bad or anything. It's just, you know, very different than it used to be for sure.
Yeah, they might not like loud shows though when their babies are trying to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually having like our winter block party tomorrow, which is just outside the Empty Bottle on Cortez and Western Avenue. And like, we really, really do our best to, you know, have neighborhood outreach and be like, in particular to the people on that block, and be like, you know, from noon to 8 p.m., it's going to be pretty noisy, but like, this is a really community driven event. So like, you know, please don't hate us for having five punk bands play on a Saturday in the middle of winter.
I mean, who doesn't like that?
Well,
I would do that. I live in a pretty small place now that might not 100% like that, but I would like that. Mm-hmm. But also think it's pretty cool for, you know, a bar music venue to really think about the external community around it. Maybe that's more common than I think it is, but I kind of don't think it's that common. But I'm outside of Ithaca, which is a college town, so it has that whole sort of collegiate drunken vibe in a lot of places.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, you know, we obviously have to like keep the lights on and stay in business and turn some sort of profit to be open for 33 years. But like, since I've started, you know, since I became co-owner and managing partner, like I'm definitely, me and my team are definitely having a hyper focus on like community driven events and like raising money for local charities and stuff. Yeah, like tomorrow it's a free festival, but we're taking donations at the gate that are going to all proceeds go to Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, because obviously, like,
nice,
you know, there's so much houselessness going on all over the country, but like it's become very, very apparent in Chicago, all over the place, that you know, these folks really need some help. So like any sort of small thing we can do to help with that. And a bunch of local businesses are jumping on our street fest too, like Dark Matter Coffee, who's a local coffee place. They're like donating a bunch of coffee, and all the proceeds from that are going to support Chicago Coalition for the Homeless too. So like really just trying to, you know, not capitalize on trying to make a bunch of money off of free street festival and just doing it for the community, you know?
Yeah, that's good. And it's such an important cause. I mean, we call it homelessness when I lived there, and really, you know, now we talk more about people being unhoused, and it was there when I was in Chicago, you know, and weirdly you would see it downtown after hours. 'Cause my time there, there was no residential stuff really in that downtown core. It was actually really weird. You know, you'd be there after six and it was a little like, whoa, where'd all the people go?
Yeah.
And now I'm sure that's shifted. And then with the pandemic, there's probably this other shift because people stopped going into offices. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, honestly, it hasn't changed downtown that much in the same way you're telling it. We're like, you know, it's pretty rare that I need to go downtown to like do business or whatever. But whenever I do, it's literally night and day. We're like, daytime is hustle and bustle, college kids, business district. And then, you know, 7 p.m. rolls around and there's nobody out there, you know? And yeah, it's definitely not a place I'd want to walk around at night necessarily.
Yeah, it's weird. Give me a lot more people. Though I will say, the most scared I ever was in Chicago was walking home from a party in Hyde Park. I don't know, it was like 2 in the morning and like 6 raccoons came out of the sewer. And I was like, hell no. That was actually the most terrified I've ever been in any urban setting. Because I was like, those are like Chicago sewer raccoons. They, your body will never be found.
Yeah.
If they get you, you'll be dragged down, never seen again. Because I think mostly, you know, most people are good people, even when they're struggling, right? Even
absolutely.
If they're unhoused or whatever, yeah. They're just, you know, they have stuff going on. A lot of times it's mental health or it's addiction related or the intersection of both or capitalism.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you on that for sure. That like the most scared I've been in Chicago is not because of people. It's because of the rats for sure.
Yeah. Maybe they were rats and not raccoons.
Yeah.
They're just really, really big.
Yeah. We got some big ones out here for sure.
So let's dive into kind of your history with drinking and how that intersected with music and all that. I mean, were you always kind of a drinker in high school, or, you know, when did all that start and when did the problems with it happen?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, it started from a pretty young age. You know, I started playing music when I was really young in my, you know, probably like 9 or 10 or something. And I think naturally every teenager kind of goes through their like musical obsessions and stuff like that. And, you know, some of my musical idols were like, you know, Elliott Smith and Slash and like, people that were kind of notorious for substance abuse. And yeah, as a teenager, I didn't necessarily have like access to drugs and alcohol as frequently as I did as an adult, but like it definitely started around, you know, 16, 17. And then once I moved to Chicago and really started, you know, actively playing music live and touring with bands is when I was able to kind of like dive into that sort of what I thought was, you know, part of being a musician was like the substance abuse. That's, you know, this whole like tortured artist sort of thing that I thought I had to strive to be. So like the real problems in addiction didn't start until I was in like my early mid 20s.
Yeah. Jeff Tweedy, one of, you know, Chicago's favorite sons, talks a lot about that notion of like the tortured artist and the kind of that it's a bunch of crap really, that being tortured and addicted and all that stuff actually creates good art.
Mm-hmm.
It just is really a distraction from, I think, your abilities to do those things or function in any way. But, you know, somehow this mythology, you know, with Hemingway and all these writers and all these people who are just sort of dark and tortured. And I can't remember who it was, someone I interviewed on this, and they were talking about Elliott Smith, and they were like, I just feel like, imagine what he would have done.
Mm-hmm.
Like what we didn't get from a brilliant artist.
Mm-hmm. 100%. You know,
and it's kind of heartbreaking to see that struggle and see people not really be able to find help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And yeah, it's just interesting to kind of look back at like, you know, my teenage idols, even like Nirvana, you know, like the mystery sort of that encompassed like Kurt Cobain's career of somebody that was struggling with addiction that died so young, and kind of how media caters to youth to like mystify that sort of tortured artist. And like being young, I think that was a really attractive thing to see someone that had such great success and obviously wanting to replicate that as a young musician down to like the actual substance abuse part, you know?
And so where, you know, where did you kind of turn? When did it crash out for you that you decided it was time to make a change?
Yeah, I mean, I think I started to really recognize that I had a problem in my late 20s when I started to take my career as a non-musician, or like my non-musical career, I started to take that more seriously and started to see how incapable I was of like maintaining that while still drinking. And so I tried to get sober probably 8 or 9, 10 times over the course of 4 years, from my late 20s and my early 30s. And like, you know, I think a lot of people go through that phase of like, oh yeah, I can totally like take a break and then start drinking again and control my drinking, control my drug.
All better now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, I stopped drinking for a month or 2 months or 6 months, whatever.
I knew I could do that.
Yeah. And then immediately fall back right into it. So after doing that a bunch of times, I was offered a co-ownership of Empty Bottle and managing partnership for it in 2022. And I thought that I was able to maintain and like control my habits or addictions really. And quickly realized that I was not able to do that. And so that was a big wake up call. On top of, you know, like I got married about 3 years ago and bought a house, and trying to maintain all these things that I really cared about and really mattered to me, and still drinking and using drugs, like I very quickly realized like I cannot do this. Like it's fucking up every aspect of my life that I care about. So yeah, that was kind of the big wake up call, was like late 2022, and just like, you know, waking up with the existential dread, the anxiety and the guilt, and just really having to force myself to be like, this isn't something I can control. I have to like stop this for good in order to be the person that I want to be, you know?
Yeah. Do you do any kind of program?
I don't do any kind of program. I have a pretty good support group of friends. A lot of people that used to work at Empty Bottle, and a lot of musicians in the Chicago area that have all gone sober in the last like 5 or 10 years. And thankfully kind of was invited into that sort of circle of people that are like, yeah, man, like we get exactly what you're going through. And yeah, there's like little meetups and stuff like that, but it's not a real program. Yeah, I was never really opposed to trying one out, but I think since I kind of had a support group right away, I didn't find it necessary, I guess.
Yeah, no, I get that. I didn't do a program, you know, and I kind of started identifying more as straight edge. I think that was also a way to publicly define being sober without saying, golly, I had issues with this, mm-hmm. you know, more like I'm choosing to be sober. And it's only been more recently where I said, you know, like, I'm just going to be public about this. You know, I have a career, I have a family, like all the things I've achieved in the last, you know, 14 years are really coming from that decision to stop drinking. So there's like, why should I be ashamed of that or mm-hmm. cover that up? I should actually be public about that, because it's the more people who just say, yeah, like we struggle, people have problems, people, you know, I had a coworker who, you know, in front of one of the partners just said, yeah, I got to go to therapy. And I was like, that's like good, right? That we can just talk about some of this stuff now and not be ashamed of it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that was something I was definitely con- learned about early on in my like sobriety journey was that like, oh my God, how are people going to perceive, you know, my publicly saying that I'm sober? I feel like maybe I should be quiet about it and not tell people or something like that. I'm sure there's like levels of guilt and anxiety in there somewhere, but I think stemming from how people would perceive that was a big one. But I agree, like, you know, I think it's super important to be able to say that, you know, you're struggling with something, and there's no, there shouldn't be any shame within that, you know, like, I think it's really empowering for other people to see that.
Yeah. And in one of the articles or pieces I listened to in advance of this, you know, there's someone else was in it from the Empty Bottle, and she was sober, and it was talking about your Nothing Assumed event you had. So you're really also creating a space with, you know, within an environment that's traditionally, I mean, it's a bar, right? So, but you're creating a sort of a new space or subspace. I don't know whatever you call it. But, you know, how did those things come about?
Yeah. So, Molly Mobley, she's the lead talent buyer of The Bottle. And she's been sober for over 3 years now, and definitely was a very big inspiration for me to get on track in the same way, too. And, you know, the Nothing Assumed idea, which is like the sober series that we have at The Bottle, like that kind of came about in the first 6 months of me being sober, where like, you know, I mean, I go to shows at my club every single day almost. And like the beginning of sobriety for me, at least, was like having a ton of social anxiety, feeling like I couldn't really fit in or talk to people or really know how to even interact with myself sometimes. But the feeling of like going to a show was always very comfortable for me, and like allowed me to feel like I was still socializing and a part of something that wasn't, you know, like I'm going to a bar and I'm sitting down and talking to someone. It's like you can walk into a showroom, see a band that's essentially playing to everyone, and still feel as if you're a part of a community without having as much social anxiety or pressure to socialize on like a one-on-one level. So it just kind of got me thinking like other people have to be feeling the same thing. Like I can't be the only person that like wants to go out, but doesn't want to socialize or doesn't feel like socializing. And so it just kind of got me thinking about it and like how I want to be better about talking about sobriety in a bar and like, you know, there's a lot of like stigma around going to a bar and not drinking or not having options. And I think like to sort of destigmatize that and make it accessible to anyone and feel comfortable or not judged for deciding not to drink alcohol is like a big part of it. Cause yeah, ultimately like everybody should be able to enjoy music, and you know, I want my bar to feel comfortable for anyone to go in and not judged. So yeah, I guess that's kind of how the idea came about that. And like, I know a pretty good amount of sober musicians, and like what better way to sort of like, discuss it and like bring it more into light and make it more acceptable than to like have shows where that's what it's all about, you know?
So do you serve any alcohol during those shows, or are those totally sober events?
So we do still serve alcohol, and that's something I was like hyper concerned about going into this, because like, I mean, you know, you've been to The Bottle, it's a pretty tight room. The actual bar is in the stage room, so it's super loud. And I was like, you know, the last thing I want to fucking happen is a sober person accidentally order an alcoholic drink and that like breaks them, you know, like I was super, super concerned about that. So like, you know, off the bat, we handed out like little handbills at the door that were like, here's all of our non-alcoholic drink options. You know, we had like a quiet, safe room if, for people that were struggling struggling with anxiety or feeling pressure in any way so they could kind of escape. But just made it like really clear, like, please, you know, it's okay to ask your bartender to make sure there's no alcohol in your drink. Like, that's why we're doing this. So yeah, we just made it super, super apparent. But yeah, we work with this Chicago non-alcoholic distillery called Ritual Zero Proof.
Yeah, who's kind of blowing up.
Yeah. Right?
I can get them in my New York State grocery chain now.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. They're super nice folks and, you know, local to Chicago. So we thankfully, like, were able to partner up with them and, like, have very, like, visual signage at the bar that's, like, these are the non-alcoholic drinks that we have. Like, you know, they have these little, like, stirring sticks that we put in the non-alcoholic drinks to, like, signify that those are the ones without alcohol. Which, yeah, like, I just wanted to make it as apparent as possible, like, what you're drinking does not have alcohol in it. Because some of what they make does, some of the spirits that they make definitely do taste like they could have alcohol in them. Like, the first time I sampled one, I was like, holy shit, does this have alcohol in it? And, like, freaked out for it just a second. But yeah, they're really great and just super helpful with, like, getting that communication across. So basically we just tried to make it as apparent as humanly possible that you can get any drink you want without alcohol in it. And, like, it's
been nice because I drank a lot of seltzer and club sodas mm-hmm. over the years. And so it's pretty cool now to get a little, if you choose it, a variety, I mean, something that tastes sophisticated, or I was never a beer guy, so I don't really go for the NA beers, but people who have them, you know, say they're really good now. So it just is great to just have this choice. And I think a lot of people who do drink actually consume that stuff as well.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I was never a huge beer drinker either. I mean, when I was drinking, I would drink anything, but beer was never like my top choice. But I will say, like, it's nice to have an option here where it's like, it's nice to have an option that kind of scratches that itch. It doesn't taste like garbage. So yeah, the non-alcoholic beers are pretty good. Yeah.
You don't have to worry about over-serving people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge one for sure. Like, you can't kick somebody out for having, like, 9 non-alcoholic beers. They're just going to be full and tired.
Right, and in the bathroom the whole night.
Exactly.
But, I mean, when I stopped drinking, I was like, oh, it is nice to just leave the restaurant or the club and not even think about, like, how many drinks I had or whatever. I can just drive home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's like no worries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really nice for sure.
And I assume though, you just kind of roll those menus all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we rotate it pretty frequently to, like, honestly, for me, it's just to try new things. But yeah, we usually have like 5 to 8 different non-alcoholic options at a time.
And have you just overall seen business growth in that outside of sober events, that now that that's on the menu, more people just go for it?
Yeah, 100%. Like, in the last year alone, we've seen non-alcoholic beverage sales increase over 600%, which is really nice. And I think, like, by having more options inherently, people are more interested in trying them. And since they don't taste bad, I think people are even more excited about it.
Right, because it's a drag to serve people stuff that tastes bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just sort of defeats the purpose a little bit.
Yeah.
To have unpleasantries in your glass.
Mm-hmm.
How's the Chicago music scene going? I feel so disconnected in some ways because it's even been a long time since I've been back, you know, to visit. But it was always such a vibrant scene, and obviously, you know, Smashing Pumpkins and Wilco, there's some big bands that have come out of there. But what I always like the jazz scene there and the blues scene, were pretty amazing. And a lot of times it was just players that you didn't even know. They weren't famous, but they were incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the music scene's thriving here for sure. I was just talking the other day, though. It's interesting being in this sort of post-pandemic time where, like, in that, like, almost two years of closure that we had within the city where, like, nothing was happening, nothing was open, there's, like, a whole new flock of bands and music that, like, I'm just continuously finding new shit all the time, which is awesome. Whereas, like, usually there's sort of this gradual, like, you know, you'll see the same 20 or 30 new bands play around over the course of like a year or something. And a handful of those will kind of blow up, where like in the last year or so, it's like 80 new bands and I've never heard of any of them. So it's really exciting in a sense, because all these people were working on music during closure and during lockdown. And like all of a sudden, right, there's this like influx of a ton of new artists and bands, and then offshoots of all of those bands. So there's a ton of great stuff. Yeah, there's a really great like DIY punk scene going on right now. Del Rey is one of my favorites right now. CB Radio Gorgeous, Repent, they're all really good bands. And yeah, like the jazz scene, I haven't been as like up to date on that as I want to be. But Isaiah Collier is really great, saxophone player, doing a bunch of cool shit. Angel Bot Dawid, sort of like on this otherworldly, sort of mystical jazz thing going on.
Yeah, you know, because Chicago jazz always did have kind of an outside vibe to it, because it wasn't New York and it wasn't like West Coast kind of cool. I mean, I guess it's the essence of Chicago kind of like wrapped up, you know, in jazz and in the history of the city and Great Migration, all the things that make Chicago kind of this amazing city,
yeah,
are coming out in those sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's definitely like some pretty freaky jazz stuff for sure. Like one of the first, I guess, jobs I had in Chicago was interning for Heaven Gallery in Wicker Park. I don't know if you ever went over there.
No.
But yeah, it was like right in Wicker Park, and they mostly had like free jazz, avant-garde noise, ambient kind of stuff there. But that's kind of how I started in the Chicago music scene, was just interning there and like taking donations at the door. But yeah, there's some really wild stuff over there.
Yeah, how does the kind of the work, your working hours, how is that on family life? I remember at the State Theater, you know, I'm coming home at 2 a.m. and you work these weird opposite hours. And I had a little kid at the time too, who was like just still getting me up at 6 a.m. Oh, so I was just perennially exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm still trying to figure out a good work-life balance. Because, yes, like, I usually start working at, like, 8 or 9 in the morning, catching up on emails, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, 5 o'clock rolls around, and I'm like, well, I guess the show's starting in a couple hours. Thankfully, I have a really, really incredible staff backing me up here. And, like, any time that I need to step away or just need, like, a night away from the club, I have like full faith that they're all going to take care of it. I guess like that's sort of the work-life balance for me. It's like, all right, I need a couple nights away from the club to just chill and really having faith in the people that I work with and just like do the right thing. It's such a huge weight off my shoulders. But I haven't quite figured out how to not work like 80 hours.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I did a bunch of freelance marketing for a number of years and just, it got exhausting because all I did was work. And, you know, so there's a little bit of freedom in working for someone else. I mean, there's pluses and minuses to it, but I certainly can just you know, go home at the end of the day, which is nice and helpful. And it's funny because we had to reschedule because you had to step in for an employee that had an emergency. So I was like, that's awesome. That's cool. Like, I believe in employers, you know, who take care of their staff. And that's one reason you probably have a great staff.
Yeah.
Is it's really is a two-way street. And I remember the president of the company I work for, my mom was in the hospital at one point. He's like, if you need to go now, you go now. He's like, this is work. He said, families first. I didn't end up needing to, but it was just such a freeing thing to just have somebody say, like, we got it. If you got to go and take care of your family, like, we got you covered.
Yeah, that's such an awesome thing to have, for sure. Like, that's something that I really try to push now that I'm, especially now that I'm like sober and a little more clear minded, where it's like time away from work is so fucking important for everybody. And like, I really push all my staff, like, if you are having a hard day, if you need some time with your family, if you, whatever you got to do, like, you know, we're all confident that if somebody needs to step away, like, we can all fill in some shoes. You know, everybody needs a day off. Like, life's too short to just be constantly working all the time. Even if you do something that you love, like, I'm really thankful to actually, like, love pretty much every aspect of my job. But even then, it's like, I got to have some time away, you know?
Yeah, and just in that recognition is super important. You know, and it does, like I said, it translates to a staff and you'll have people who want to stay, but also not super common in, like, broadly speaking, the hospitality world, right? Where the hours can be long. It's a people facing job, which people are great and people are not great sometimes. And drunk people can really, really be not great. So it is a, you know, it's a hard job and it's the hours can be long. And so the idea of creating that kind of emotionally safe environment for your staff is super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, even just the other day we had like a full staff meeting, and like one of the first things I said to everybody was like, you know, we are a hospitality focused business. Like, even working the door, I'm a huge believer that, like, if you're going to see a show and the door person is an asshole, you're going to enjoy that show way less. So, like, we really try to encourage, like, everybody just be kind and authentic. You don't have to, like, kiss ass, but, like, every interaction that you have on a, like, customer level, like, does affect somebody's experience, which can be a lot to handle and, like, a big weight in theory. But, like, I just encourage everybody all the time, like, if you're having a bad day, like, it's okay to tell your coworkers, like, hey, I'm having a shitty day. Like, I just need to expel that. Like, I'm going to rein it in, but I just want you to know I'm having a tough time. And if somebody's having such a bad day that they need to step away, that they're comfortable saying that and knowing that somebody's going to fill in for them and not be upset, you know? Like, I think I really wish more places had cultivated that when I was, you know, doing hourly work. But, yeah. Unfortunately, it's pretty rare, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, I think some of that's changing. There's, and I bring up this place a lot in Ithaca, Watershed. You know, her staff, it's a bar. It's like a bar for grownups, too, which is great. And lots of NA stuff, but also teas and coffee. And just, it's a cool vibe. That is not a tip-based job. You know, they get, like, a living wage there. Because a lot of those places that are tip-based, it's rough, right? You don't know what you can count on. What if you have a slow night, you know, and you're counting on those tips to help pay your rent? You know, it's a tough business, even more so than a regular hourly-based job, which also is hard. You know, I've been salaried for so long. Sometimes I forget. I'm like, oh, right, I can just, like, go get my kid or my do this, or I have to go to the dentist and it's no big deal because I'm in a place full of salaried people. And that's what you do, is you just, like, right, I have a dentist appointment at 11. So I'll see you in an hour. And it's not like that at other places, especially sort of hospitality-based places.
Yeah, for sure. And like, that's definitely something that's been weighing on my mind in the last year or so, me kind of being in this ownership position. It's like, you know, the city of Chicago, or at least a lot of places in Chicago, are still very tip-based, and that's, you know, the bottle included. And like, how can I get my staff more cash without tips? Like, it's something that I, you know, constantly trying to brainstorm, like, with the sort of inconsistent nature of shows, and like, that dictates how busy the bar is. Granted, like, I'm super thankful that we're busy more often than not, but, you know, I still feel guilty if it's a slow night and there's only 40 people there and like, nobody really makes any money in tips. Like, how do I raise people's rates without going under, essentially, you know? I haven't figured it out yet, but I am trying to implement some ways to like get people more hourly rates, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good even that you're just thinking about it, right? And like trying to find ways, because it is hard, right? People need health insurance. They need all these things that it's really become harder and harder for business owners to provide. I mean, health insurance has just gotten totally insane.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first moved to the Ithaca area, I worked at this little book publisher, and every business in town was a member of the Chamber of Commerce. Because back then, if you were a chamber member, you could buy into their health insurance pool. The health insurance industry changed those laws. So you can't do that. So you went from having whatever in Ithaca, you know, a pool of 100,000, you know, it's not a huge city, but you know, a big pool through the chamber, to that business was three people. And there's no buying power for insurance. So all of a sudden the prices skyrocket and the quality goes way down.
Yeah, it's pretty tough out there, man. Like, I really want to be able to make like some big changes and really like help people. It just sometimes feels like the system is rigged already, you know?
I mean, I've always said one of like the best things to do for entrepreneurship is to have a single payer healthcare system. Because there's so many brilliant ideas out there, and the person can't do it because they've got the job that has the insurance for their family. It just, you know, there's a better way to do it that would actually make the economy work better. I mean, even that you're just trying to figure it out is amazing, because a lot of people just shrug their shoulders. So it's commendable that it's on your radar and you wrestle with it.
Yeah. Gotta try, you know?
Yeah. Is your wife sober? Do you have a sober house, or how does that work for you?
Yeah. So my wife, she was never really a big drinker in general. So we have an alcohol-free house. That was like a big one for me, where I was like, I, you know, can't have this in my house at all. And she was like, yeah, that's fine. I like never drink anyways.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that was easy enough. She smokes weed, which helps. She has some like chronic pain. She got hit by a car about 8 years ago and had to have several spinal surgeries. So like smoking marijuana helps with her chronic pain a lot. And that never really bothers me. I mean, like, I was never a big weed smoker myself. Like, I did when I was living in Colorado when I was 18, but like it pretty much ended when I moved to Chicago. I guess we pretty much have a sober house other than that, but that doesn't really bother me very much.
And a better choice than opioids.
100%.
To control chronic pain.
100%.
You know, and that's sort of one of those interesting, you know, things now as we see marijuana legalized and finding, you know, I've actually never smoked pot, but there, you know, are people who find it for anxiety and and chronic pain and things that it can be useful. And it's interesting to sort of see that balance play out. I think in New York, before it was legalized, everyone just tried to get a medical marijuana card, you know, like, oh, yep, yeah, I need it. But, you know, I think there are people who legitimately, it really does make a difference. And I'm a believer in harm reduction too. I mean, that's, you know, your wife's not in that category, but that, you know, there are people out there who, you know, marijuana would be a better choice for them than something else on the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, I don't think that I like condone drinking alcohol necessarily. I think I feel the same way with, you know, weed and whatnot, where it's like, it works great for some people and some people have no problem with it. But yeah, like I think smoking weed is a way better option than opioids in any way, if it works for people, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I have friends that drink, we're a sober house. We had our wedding in June was sober, and
it's awesome.
You know, which I think a few people were like, huh? I mean, saved us a lot of money. That's for sure. Because alcohol is really expensive.
Yeah, it sure is.
Especially if, you know, the woman who cuts my hair is talking about her wedding planning. And I was like, what? This is like insanity. These dollar signs that you're telling me about are just totally crazy to me.
Yeah.
I mean, we found this funky old church and it was small. And she's like kicking around $10,000 for the bar and all this. I'm like, this is madness.
I know.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I could think of spending money differently than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny, like, that is usually like the second or first biggest expense at a wedding is like the room rental and then the alcohol. You know, I mean, if you have 100 people going to your wedding or something, that's like 10 grand. It's insane.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's astonishing to me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I guess that's not a down payment on a house anymore. But not even close anywhere, even like the most. Yeah. Tiny little crappy house, I think anywhere now that wouldn't be a down payment on it, but
it's probably a really good vacation though.
It'd probably be a pretty incredible vacation,
right?
To a pretty incredible place.
Yeah. I mean,
or a good honeymoon.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's definitely something like that really struck me after the first like 6 or 7 months of being sober, is like, holy shit, I am saving so much money. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty social person. So like when I was drinking, I would go out outside of like working in a club. I would still go out like 5-6 nights a week. You know, and it just sucks up so, so much money.
Yeah. I mean, you could probably drop more than $50 a night. Easy.
Oh yeah. I would say that definitely. Yeah.
Or more.
Exactly.
Or more, which, right, when you add it up, and I just think about that when I go off to get coffee in the afternoon.
Like, oh, my gosh.
Like, that adds up, too. Uh-huh. So,
yeah.
But need my afternoon coffee to help with the work day. Mm-hmm.
It makes me feel a lot less bad having that afternoon coffee and being like, you know what? I didn't spend $500 on alcohol this month. I can go get a cup of coffee.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think about that, people who smoke stuff.
Oh, man.
I'm like, man, mm-hmm. Like.
It's so I mean,
the price of all that stuff is just bananas.
Yeah, it's so outrageous. Like, I mean, like, I think a pack of cigarettes here probably costs like $18 or $19 now. Like,
that's just,
yeah,
it's so wacky.
It's outrageous. Yeah. I'd rather go on vacation.
Yeah. You got to not work, though, to do that. Life goal.
I'm working towards it.
Well, all right. Get that team. So do you guys have mostly local people, or you have touring bands that come through?
Yeah, we have touring bands from all over the world. Yeah. I mean, it's primarily local, or I would say like 2/3 local, 1/3 touring band. Yeah. But yeah. We have bands from all over the country, all over the world.
That's cool. I do miss Chicago. I watch The Bear now, you know, to get like a little, my little flavor of the west side of Chicago, which I think it actually captures like pretty well. I honestly, that feeling.
I honestly haven't seen that yet. I feel like I'm waiting to see it. I don't know what I'm waiting for, but
We actually just, my wife and I just started it, and we just don't have very much time. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we joke we've seen 4 movies together, you know? It just, we're so busy and at soccer tournaments and doing all this stuff, but occasionally, like, we'll sit down and watch some episodes. I mean, there's definitely, like, an addiction theme that runs through that, mm-hmm. and I feel like it captures the intensity of the restaurant kitchen mm-hmm. pretty well. But the soundtrack is fucking killer.
Oh yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. They've like spent their music supervisor has a budget on that show. So that's like pretty cool mm-hmm. with some Chicago based bands, but other stuff. So that to me was in the first episode, probably the biggest selling point, because that's my fantasy job in life.
Oh my God, that would be so cool.
I just don't know how to make that happen, and now I'm in my 50s, so it's probably not going to happen. But that, to me, is like, I didn't even know that was a thing mm-hmm. when I was younger, because I grew up playing music and played saxophone and played through college and kind of went in a different direction. But I was like, oh, that is probably the coolest job in the world.
That would be
and
so
pretty,
awesome.
Like, pretty chill. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would love to do that.
Well, this was super cool, and I totally appreciate you taking the time. And if I get back to Chicago anytime, I will swing by.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Like, this was a blast. It's also really nice to just be able to like talk about being sober with like-minded people. I feel like it's pretty rare. So I'm super thankful to be here. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm hoping it gets less and less rare. I mean, that's mm-hmm. part of why I do what I do. And, I ask most people and they say yes. Even a few people who are, I got the singer for Everclear. That was like pretty good.
That's awesome.
You know?
Yeah.
He's like pretty famous. So it's fun. Sometimes it's the less famous people that get the most listens, which has also been interesting to sort of watch that, but it is fun to talk to lots of people. And mm-hmm. I just actually posted tonight a guy who is an Army Ranger for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And I'd really wanted to talk to somebody who had been in the military and that experience, because that community is one that really struggles with addiction and mm-hmm. being unhoused and mental health stuff. So yeah, it's cool to get people in different things. And when I heard about you and what was going on in the Empty Bottle, I really wanted to check it out.
Hell yeah.
Talk to you.
Thank you so much, man. And yeah, please come and visit.
Absolutely.
You're welcome anytime. You're on the guest list.
Thanks for listening. For more information, for links to any music or books we talked about, or to buy some Sober Dad Crew merchandise, please visit soberdadcrew.com.